This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and you can call me Kareem, please.
I was hoping you'd say you can identify me as a writer and activist who once played some basketball.
That's too long.
Too long, maybe, but not wrong. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA's all-time leading scorer, has written over a dozen books, history, social commentary, kids' books, autobiography, and he's only 71. Anyway, I had the opportunity to talk with Kareem recently. One of the things on his mind was his relationship with celebrated college basketball coach John Wooden, who recruited Kareem to UCLA in 1965 when Kareem was still Lew Alcindor.
For me, it was an insight into what Mr. Wooden was all about when I first met him, because we started talking and we immediately got off the subject of basketball. And he said, you know, I noticed that you have good grades and UCLA is an excellent school. I expect you to do well here. And, you know, I was kind of surprised. You know, most basketball coaches don't care about that. And, you know, I understood immediately that we were simpatico that way. I was at UCLA to get an education, and we struck it off right away in terms of vision and appreciation of each other's goals.
Still, on the surface, the young, gangly 7'2 center and his middle-aged coach couldn't have been less alike. Kareem, black and New York. Wooden, white and Indiana. And it didn't take long for Kareem to begin to understand how their different backgrounds would determine how they handled circumstances they encountered together. Take, for example, a meal they shared at a sports bar during Kareem's recruiting visit.
Well, we went to the Bat Rack and had dinner. Coach Wooden was getting to know me, and a woman, a very elderly white woman, approached Coach Wooden. I was standing right near him, and she asked him some questions about me and wanted to know how tall I was. And then she used the N-word in saying that she'd never seen anybody that tall.
It wasn't how the dinner was supposed to have gone, but even at 18, Kareem was not naive.
You know, I had been through that before. It was nothing new to me. So, you know, I dealt with it, but Coach Wooden was flabbergasted. He was stunned. He didn't know how to reply. She walked off and to her, it was just her feeling out her curiosity about my height.
It seems to me that he might have been stuck. I mean, obviously, he doesn't want to just let this slide, but also he doesn't want to insult an elderly woman, I guess.
Right. You didn't expect to hear that from someone like that. It reminds me of did you see the movie Blazing Saddles?
I did indeed.
Yeah, when Cleavon Little is talking to the lady that had the pies, and she uses the N-word like that.
Good evening, Sheriff. Sorry about the up yours. I hope this apple pile in some small way say thank you for your ingenuity and courage in defeating that horrible Mongol.
Well, thank you. Much obliged. Good night.
It's kind of the same thing, you know?
Thus began this development of a lasting friendship between a coach who didn't know what to do when an old lady referred to his player and dinner guest with a racial slur, and a player who could appreciate and empathize with his coach's discomfort. John Wooden was in his mid-50s when he recruited the 18-year-old Kareem. I was beginning to understand how the older man, who was supposed to be the teacher, learned from the younger one, which was part of what Kareem had on his mind when we spoke, because in 1966, when Kareem, still known as Lew Alcindor, began carrying the UCLA basketball program to heights previously unimagined, John Wooden found himself in a position he'd never experienced.
I think I took some of the fun out of it for him, because prior to me coming to UCLA, UCLA were, the first year they won the NCAA tournament, they were underdogs. And then the second year, everybody was like excited to see them repeat. And then here I come along, and the three NCAA tournaments that I played in were the first three of seven in a row. People got sick of UCLA at that point. And then instead of playing to win, coach had to coach in a way to not to lose.
Then in the final 20 minutes, the UCLA blitz begins. And as usual, Lew Alcindor is the center of attraction.
it's tough being number one. It's tough to stay up there and maintain that excellence and try to extend your ability to dominate.
So there was pressure, even with the best player in the country piling up points, while UCLA overwhelmed opponents by scores like 116-78 and 122-57. But Kareem also recalls that during those days, for the players and their coach, there was time for learning. Yeah, that word again. Sometimes during games, and on one especially memorable occasion in early December 1968, after they'd put another win in the books.
Well, we were on a bus trip going between games that we had to play in the Midwest. We were driving from Columbus to Notre Dame. And we just kind of like backed into a conversation, me and some of the guys, about our various religious beliefs. And we had a pretty varied group of guys. We had two Jewish guys on the team and a couple guys in a fellowship of Christian athletes. And then I had converted to Islam, but I hadn't told anybody about it. And I started to talk about my religious beliefs. And we kind of got to the point where we started to listen to each other. You know, we didn't try to dominate the conversation with proselytizing and demanding that everybody see it the way that one or the other of us wanted to see it. It was a nice experience. Coach Wooden kind of came and stood on the periphery and listened and kind of edged us on in order to give everybody the opportunity to speak and really brought us close together.
Did that ever happen again?
No, I don't think it did, because, you know, the time and quiet and, you know, just no interference. Good ride, you know.
So there was all that winning. UCLA won 88 regular season games and lost just two while Kareem was there. And there was learning, but it wasn't all sweetness and light. Some of Kareem's teammates took issue with John Wooden's rules, which they felt were arbitrary. It was the 60s, after all. One Wooden mandate, short hair, allegedly because the coach thought otherwise his players might leave the gym after showering with wet hair and get colds. But Kareem was able to see beyond Wooden's rules and motivational sayings to the coach's deeper purpose.
He didn't see himself as someone who dehumanized the people that he had to work with in terms of coaching them. How did Coach describe it? He said, a coach is someone who can criticize without creating resentment.
And, you're laughing. It sounds like maybe it didn't always work.
No, it did. He knew how to do it.
And sometimes Coach Wooden surprised Kareem with how well he knew how to do it. In 1968, Kareem was urged to join the U.S. team that would be competing at the Olympics in Mexico City. As a patriot, Coach Wooden expected no less. Kareem was not receptive.
For me, that was an especially sore issue. Dr. King had just been assassinated. I wasn't feeling very patriotic. But what really affected me was the fact that I was going to have to work with Avery Brundage. Avery Brundage is the individual who told the Jewish players on the 1936 Olympic team that they couldn't compete because it would annoy Mr. Hitler. And, you know, he was still the chairman of the Olympic Committee, and I wasn't going to do anything with him. So for me, it was an easy decision.
An easy decision that Kareem thought might cause a rupture in his relationship with Coach Wooden, but Wooden never mentioned it. And then many years later, Kareem learned that John Wooden had recalled and processed the lessons he'd begun learning at that dinner at the bat rack.
Yes, John Wooden received a letter from a woman that was upset that I was considering a boycott of the Olympic Games. And then Coach Wooden wrote back to her and said that he had seen firsthand what black Americans have to deal with at times, and he understood why a protest would be something that any black American with common sense might want to consider. He got that. I have the letter, and, you know, I printed it, and it's published.
How did you come into possession of that letter that Wooden had written in response to the woman who wrote him?
Coach Wooden gave it to me. He had saved it, and he said that he thought that I should have it. It's one of my prized possessions, you know, because it's written in his hand.
As a very large black man and an astonishingly successful player in hostile arenas, Kareem was often the target of abuse. From time to time, John Wooden witnessed it. He tried to reinforce the idea that Kareem should try to refrain from judging everybody on the basis of the actions of those who insulted him. But Kareem didn't realize how deeply some of those incidents had affected his coach. As Kareem recalled, "It wasn't until years later that I found out that because of me, he had begun to question his own belief in the innate goodness of people." When Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's mother died in 1997, he and John Wooden talked at length, as they had when John Wooden's wife passed away in 1985. And when Wooden emerged from the depression into which the death of his wife of half a century had plunged him, it was Kareem he called to say, "I found my sense of purpose again." It must have felt like particularly good news. Certainly John Wooden, who died in 2010 at the age of 99, had a lot to do with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's ongoing discovery of his own sense of purpose as a teammate and a man.
And I'm so thankful. You know, I learned from this man from day one until the day he passed. And since he has passed, I'm still learning from my experiences with him. He was an incredible human being.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's most recent book is Coach Wooden and Me, Our 50-Year Friendship on and Off the Court. You can find a link to it at onlyagame.org. Do me a favor. Consider leaving a review of Only a Game on your favorite podcast app. It helps other listeners to find our show. Growing up in one of the city's poorer neighborhoods, Ray Flynn had no dreams of one day being elected mayor of Boston.
Nobody told us that we could play major league sports. Nobody told us we could be successful. Nobody ever told us that we could achieve anything.
And then Flynn met Jackie Robinson. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. NFL owners have approved a policy that will require players on the field to stand during the playing of the national anthem, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Think Progress's Lindsey Gibbs and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Bill.
According to this new NFL policy, players can stay in the locker room if they wish to during the playing of the national anthem, but if they are on the field, those who, quote, do not stand and show respect for the flag and anthem will receive, quote, appropriate discipline. The owners are apparently trying to reach some kind of compromise between the president of the United States on one side. He loudly suggested last year that firing players who don't demonstrate respect for the flag would be a good thing to do. And between the players themselves who wish to exercise their rights. The new policy, as far as I'm concerned, is ridiculous, and it would be funny if it didn't feel like one more step in the imposition of faux patriotism, and also if it wasn't for the infringement of the right of free speech and protest. In a more reasonable, less crazy world, maybe everybody would see that playing the national anthem and saluting the flag before a football game is unnecessary, but apparently that's too much to ask. I am curious, though, to hear your reaction to this new policy. Lindsey, you first.
I agree. It's pretty ridiculous. And President Trump was talking and suggested that if a player doesn't come out and stand for the national anthem, perhaps they shouldn't be in this country at all. It's clear that this is an issue that he uses particularly to rile up his base and to rile up particularly sentiment against African Americans. And he's going to continue to find ways to do it because it works for his base. So the NFL needs to remember that they can't win this battle. They need to stand up for their players and stand up for the right to peacefully protest.
Unfortunately, the NFL owners allowed Donald Trump to frame this issue for them. The owners have had numerous conversations with the players in which they said their kneeling was to protest social injustices, but the owners this week echoed what Trump called this, a disrespectful protest of the flag, the anthem, and the military. And unfortunately, this is now going to continue to be a problem for the NFL owners' bottom line, even though what they did this week was an attempt to make this bad issue for their bottom line go away.
Yeah, more specifically, the initial protests were, yes, against the failure of justice in this country, but more specifically, they were protesting the killing of black people in the street by police officers, and that has kind of been forgotten by people who are all riled up about the flag and the anthem. And I hope that the initial purpose of the protest can be remembered as part of this discussion as we go forward. Lindsay, your turn.
Well, this weekend, Danica Patrick will race in her last race as a professional driver. She's going to be competing in the Indianapolis 500, and this is her goodbye to the sport that made her famous. She's been a real trailblazer for women within motorsports. She has the highest finish by any female driver at both the Indianapolis 500 and the Daytona 500. She's one of only 14 drivers to have led laps in both races. She was the first woman to have a pole in the top series in NASCAR, had the most top 10s, etc. But she's only won one race in her career. That was 10 years ago in IndyCar. And really, her celebrity far surpassed the success that she had on the track. She was able to utilize her image and to utilize the fact that she was a woman as a way to be a benefit to her within NASCAR, as opposed to a detriment like it has been for so many. She really, I would say, exploited her image and utilized her image with GoDaddy in those racy Super Bowl ads. And that put a lot of people off, especially, you know, feminists. It's very interesting. She's partnering with GoDaddy here at the end of her career. And they are actually this time really portraying her as a businesswoman. So we've kind of come full circle now. And she's really ready to continue to have a successful career. But I'm going to really miss seeing her on race days, even with this complicated legacy. It's so much fun to look out there and to see a woman racing alongside all these men.
Don, will you also miss seeing Danica Patrick in the fire suit?
I will. Here's a shameless plug for my employer, ESPN. Danica will host the ESPYs this July. Mm-hmm. She will be the first female to do so. You know, I'm really excited, as Lindsay said, about her next chapter as an entrepreneur. And it seems that she's been making a lot of moves in every step she's made on the racetrack and away from it about women's empowerment. And so I think we'll see that next chapter for her, and it'll start in July at the ESPYs in L.A.
Well, you have said, both of you, wonderful things about Danica Patrick, and I don't have a lot to add except to say congratulations for leaving this exceptionally dangerous sport in one piece. And I wish her a long and pleasant retirement.
Yeah, I think it's just been inspiring to watch her persevere, even if it hasn't always been in the way that's been the most popular, and it hasn't always been with the best finishes. And I'm disappointed, though, that there aren't more women in the sport that she leaves behind. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows how rare she was. And it's going to be maybe another decade or so until we see the impact of all those young girls in fire suits coming to the tracks to get her autograph.
Don, you're our closer this week.
The NBA, Major League Baseball, and the PGA Tour all want 1% of all the wagers placed in legal betting shops across America. Now, their name for this is an integrity fee. They argue this new revenue stream will help them ensure the integrity of their games because, as we all know, gamblers don't like betting on things that are fixed.
Unless they're the ones who fixed them.
That's right. Integrity fee belongs in the euphemism Hall of Fame. Since the Black Sox baseball scandal, all the major sports leagues have tried to protect the integrity of their games because, of course, it's good business. But they're not the only ones who want to protect the integrity of the games. The most interested people in protecting the integrity of the games are the bookies themselves, as Brent Musburger recently said on ESPN.
Any unhealthy money shows on that computer within minutes, and the alarm bells go on around the globe. So they've been checking on the integrity of this game for a long, long time.
Interestingly, the NFL owners, who never turn down a chance to tap a fresh revenue stream, are opposed to the integrity fee. They're thrilled about legalized gambling because there'll be all sorts of other ways that they can monetize it, but they don't like the integrity fee because they feel sure the state legislatures won't go for billionaires like Jerry Jones and Robert Kraft siphoning off 1% of the VIG. And you know what? They're right. In New Jersey, state legislators are deeply offended by the league's push for this. Can we call it the show me the money fee? They say that 1% for the leagues who fought tooth and nail to stop legal wagering for years and years just isn't right.
I mean, I do have to say I'm glad that the NFL isn't advocating for this, because I just might pass out from the irony if the NFL was advocating for an integrity fee for anything.
Now, this reminds me a little bit of something that happened a couple of years ago when the leadership, I think it was CONCACAF in FIFA, changed. And the first thing that the guy who took over did was establish an integrity commission. And nobody was fooled. Yeah. Business as usual went on, and FIFA remained organized crime. So I'm not sure this is going to change anything. If it does happen, I think we all do our best to figure out what's going on and either bet accordingly or, more intelligently, keep our wallets in our pockets and not bet at all on sports. I was cured of that many years ago at the racetrack. In any case, Don, I'll let you wrap it up.
Yeah, there's just a delicious irony, right? I mean, you have had all these major sports leagues fighting tooth and nail against legalized gambling, including, you know, the Supreme Court decision now that has opened the floodgates. And the moment that happens, they've got their hands out.
Me just, some too.
Yeah, exactly. It's just too rich.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Think Progress's Lindsay Gibbs and ESPN's Don Van Notte Jr. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Ray Flynn served as the mayor of Boston and later as ambassador to the Vatican. He met presidents and popes, but the person who had the biggest impact on Flynn's life was a ballplayer. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Ray Flynn was a 10-year-old sports fan the first time he met Jackie Robinson.
All I ever wanted, I can say it now, I'm not running for political office, but all I ever wanted to be was play for the Celtics or for the Red Sox, not be mayor.
Flynn says he probably should have played shortstop because he had a good throwing arm, but he played second base because that was the position Jackie Robinson played. Flynn grew up Irish Catholic in South Boston. Jackie Robinson was, of course, an African American who grew up in Southern California. But Flynn says he and his hero had more than just baseball in common. Robinson's father left when he was a baby. Flynn was growing up without his father, too. Stephen Flynn was a dock worker who got sick on the job. He ended up in the hospital for 5 years.
A lot of longshoremen got hurt or sick. There's all kinds of tuberculosis and problems like that. My mother cleaned office buildings at night. So even when I was 10 years old, I had to go out and hustle and try to make a few dollars and try to help my mother out as best as I could.
Flynn shined shoes. He sold newspapers. Sometimes, after selling papers at the ballparks, Boston had two major league teams back then, Flynn would stick around to ask for autographs. The city's National League team, the Boston Braves, played just a mile up the road from Fenway Park.
I recall very vividly standing outside the visitors' locker room at Braves Field, as opposed to the home team locker room, where all the young kids from Roxbury, Southie, Charlestown, Brighton, all wanted to get the Braves' autographs. I wanted to get the best player's autograph.
And the very best player, at least in the eyes of 10-year-old Ray Flynn, was Jackie Robinson.
So he comes out of the locker room, and I saw him, and I went up to him, and I says, "Mr. Robinson, I said, could I have your autograph?" And he looks at me, and he says, "Sure." So he signs the autograph book for me, and I said, "Mr. Robinson, could I carry your bag?" He looks at me hesitantly and he says, "Sure, take the bag." So he gave me the bag. I was barely able to carry it. I was so young. I carried the bag up to the taxi stand on the main street. He gets in the taxi. He puts his hand in his pocket and takes out some money. And he says, "Here, kid, thanks for carrying my bag." And I says, "Oh, Mr. Robinson," I says, "I don't want any money." I said, "It was a real honor, you know, to carry your bag." This kid from South Boston here. He looks at me and then he says, "Well, I'll see you again." I says, "Okay, Mr. Robinson," and off he goes to the hotel. You know, I went home and I told my brother, my older brother, and he says, "You mean to say he offered you money and you didn't take it?" "Wow," he says, "I would have taken the money."
Flynn knew his family could use the cash, but he says letting Jackie Robinson know that he had a fan in Boston was more important.
Well, about 2 weeks later, the Dodgers are back in town again. The Brooklyn Dodgers are back in town again playing the Braves. Here I am in the same location, the same situation. About 30 or 40 kids from Boston are all waiting outside the Braves locker room to get the Braves autograph. And I'm there with Jackie Robinson. He looks at me. He says, "You already got my autograph." I says, "Yeah, I got your autograph." I said, "Mr. Robinson, can I carry your bag again?" It would seem like he would always come out of the locker room and he'd look around and he'd see me there. We used to talk back and forth, but he just had this instinct of saying the right thing. He knew how I was dressed. I didn't have expensive clothes, just shabby dungarees and an old sweatshirt. He could tell that there wasn't much money there. But he would just give you these words of encouragement.
Flynn learned everything he could about Robinson's life, not just the statistics, which he can still rattle off, but also about Robinson's time before Major League Baseball, graduating from UCLA, serving as an officer in the Army. Flynn even studied Robinson's family.
I mean, I knew the whole story about Jackie Robinson A to Z, and every time I had the chance of walking with him up to the taxi stand, I'd always bring up some kind of little fact or statistic. And he says to me, "How old are you?" I says, "I'm 10 years old." He said, "How do you know all this?" Then he says, "I hope you're as smart in math and English as you are about Jackie Robinson's background in history and sports."
The walk from the visitor's clubhouse to the taxi stand on Commonwealth Avenue didn't take long. It couldn't have been more than a block or two. But between those brief encounters and the things he read about Robinson in the papers he sold, Flynn came to realize just how much adversity Robinson had overcome. And he came to realize that he could overcome his circumstances, too.
Nobody told us to go to college. Nobody told us that we could play major league sports. Nobody told us we could be successful. Nobody ever told us that we could achieve anything. And that's what Jackie Robinson did. He used to inspire young people to do things that they probably didn't think they could do.
Ray Flynn became a very good college basketball player. He even made it briefly onto the Boston Celtics roster, but was cut before the season began. Once it became clear that he wasn't going to make it as an athlete, Flynn decided his life's work would be to help kids, kids who were poor, like he had been. First, he was a coach. Then in 1971, he became a state representative. That's when he met Jackie Robinson again.
Just as I was starting to come up, Jackie was starting to fail.
Jackie Robinson had diabetes. By the end, he was almost blind and had trouble walking. Flynn was friendly with the mayor of New York, so he asked for a favor. Could you call Jackie Robinson and see if he'd be up for a visit from a politician from South Boston? Robinson said yes.
So I hopped on the train. I went down to New York. There was a police officer with me, showed me the way. And I went in and I saw Jackie Robinson, invited me right in, he and his wife. He made us sandwiches and we sat and talked. And he said, "Why are you so interested in wanting to talk to me? You were kind of young when I was at my heyday." So I says, "Mr. Robinson," I says, he says, "Stop. You're going to start calling me Jackie now." I says, "Okay." I said I was the little kid that was waiting outside the visitor's locker room at Braves Field.
"Unbelievable," Ray Flynn remembers Jackie Robinson saying. "You're my number one fan." Flynn isn't sure Robinson actually remembered him. How could he? He must have met so many kids over the years. They talked over the phone a few times after that, but they never again met in person. Robinson died in 1972.
Ray Flynn went on to become a city councilor, then mayor in 1983. In 1993, Flynn left Boston to become the ambassador to the Vatican. That's where he became close with Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa. Ray Flynn lives a quieter life now. He takes care of his grandson, who's disabled. Together, they explore the city. And whenever he gets the chance, Flynn talks about meeting Jackie Robinson. He says it's a story kids today need to hear.
I'd worked with popes, presidents, and prime ministers. I knew two saints, personal friends of two saints. But I learned more about life from Jackie Robinson than I learned from any politician that I ever met.
That story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. As a kid, Jessie Graff had a clear vision for her future. She ran the plan by her mom.
I told her, when I grow up, I'm going to be the next Xena. When Lucy Lawless retires, I'll just take her place.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day. And there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a Stanley Cup wrong is righted 46 years after the fact. It's a story that has a nice ring to it. But right now, it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Stanley Cup final begins on Monday. The Washington Capitals will be there. It's been 13 years that Alex Ovechkin has been waiting to play in a Stanley Cup final, and his moment has come. So, you like him for 2 goals and 3 assists in every game against Las Vegas?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the burden is off now. You know, the whole you can't get by Pittsburgh, Sidney Crosby, nyan-nyan-ya-boo-boo that he's had to live with his entire career. He is the greatest shooter of the puck I've ever seen. And while you know my heart is with my Vegas Golden Knights, I hope he has a huge series.
Those Vegas Golden Knights have waited an entire hockey season to get to the finals. They are the second expansion team to reach the final series of anything. The St. Louis Blues did it back in 1968. So, will the Knights' ride end in triumph or tears?
I think the Knights are going to win the Stanley Cup, and I think it's going to be in the lobby of Caesar's Palace for a year or so. They are very, very good. Marc-Andre Fleury is having a heroic playoff series in goal. I think they're going to win. I think they're going to beat Washington.
NFL owners approved a new policy this week which requires players to stand if they are on the field during the performance of the national anthem, or they can stay in the locker room if they don't wish to stand. The policy also subjects teams to a fine if players disobey this rule. What could possibly go wrong?
Gee, it's hard to believe the NFL would look at a bad situation and make it terrible. But they've managed to do it. First of all, the staying in the locker room is a fig leaf, and everybody knows it. As soon as a lot of players stay in the locker room, the president's going to have another temper tantrum, and the NFL's going to pass a rule saying you can't stay in the locker room either. This is bad in so many different ways. It's an offense against free expression. It's racially motivated. I can't tell you how many different ways this is bad.
According to Jerry Wunsch, who used to play for the Seattle Seahawks, his former team hired private investigators to follow him around in order to see if he was, in fact, as injured as he claimed to be. Didn't it occur to the Seahawks to take the word of the 5 doctors who had certified that Wunsch had, quote, closed head trauma, lumbar degenerative disc disease, mechanical neck pain, and post-concussion syndrome, among other problems?
Yeah, apparently not. They hired private investigators to haunt him to make sure he wasn't lifting anything that they thought was too heavy for him. This is a nightmare.
Some indication that he's not alone.
No, there are other Seahawks who are saying the same thing.
Quarterback Nick Foles and the Philadelphia Eagles have agreed on a contract that could pay him up to $500,000 per game, and it's a kind of a complicated contract, I think, right?
Yeah, because despite Nick Foles' magnificent performance in the Super Bowl, he's still his team's backup quarterback. So there are all kinds of incentives built into this. If he plays 33% of the snaps and the team wins, and then he gets a maximum value of $8 million, and it goes back and forth. And meanwhile, poor Carson Wentz is rehabbing, wondering what the heck's going on. The opportunities for management mischief in this contract are staggering.
Yeah, absolutely. On Thursday, President Trump pardoned late boxer Jack Johnson for his violation of the Mann Act back in 1913. That's a good thing because Jack Johnson's conviction was a sham. Why did pardoning him take a century?
Well, I have no idea, but Jack Johnson has been doing great work with Frederick Douglass. Everybody says so.
Everybody
does. And by the way, not everybody knows Jack Johnson was a great boxer.
No, and everybody in this case includes Sylvester Stallone, who was the guy that tipped off the president that Jack Johnson ought to be pardoned.
Yeah, by the way, can you imagine what would happen if similar charges were brought against the boxer today, what the president's reaction would be?
Brandi Chastain was inducted into the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame on Monday. The honor included the unveiling of a plaque featuring Chastain's likeness, except that it didn't look a bit like her. Some people have said it looks more like actor Gary Busey or former President Jimmy Carter. I myself think it looks exactly like sports writer Peter King.
I think you're right, actually. Bill, what is it about soccer that makes them hire incompetent artists?
Know.
I mean, we had the Ronaldo thing where he looked like a bouncer at a strip club.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't even look like a human being.
And we've got this thing that obviously got mixed up in production with something. I don't know.
Well, the outcry over this has been so
loud. I mean,
if these
people had designed the Statue of Liberty, she'd be standing on her head.
The outcry has been sufficiently loud that there will be another plaque. And I wonder who it's going to look like. I feel bad for Brandi Chastain. She had a great career. She won everything there was to win.
And now she's immortalized as Peter King.
As Peter King. Finally, Charlie,
yes.
A reporter named Haley Moore was doing a live interview on the track for Britain's At the Races on Tuesday when one of the horses, Give Him a Clump is the horse's name, got loose and started running toward Ms. Moore. What happened next?
She grabbed his bridle and brought the horse under control despite being dragged for about 10 yards.
She did do that.
This is the most badass TV reporter I've seen in years.
And then she did her TV report.
Of course she did. A little grass stain, but that's okay.
When all was calm and she could make her report, she said, "It was the quickest moving horse that I've ever tried to catch." She's done it before.
Of course she has. Of course, you don't learn that skill on the off the cuff. You have to, learn how to lay out and grab the bridle of a moving horse.
Wrangler. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Jessi Graf has accomplished athletic feats that no woman before her had achieved. But growing up, Graf's role model didn't have anything to do with sports. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
When Jessi Graf was 12 years old, she wasn't set on becoming a pioneering athlete. She was set on becoming a superhero. More specifically, a warrior princess.
She was Xena, a mighty princess forged in the heat of battle.
She was just like this strong, heroic woman who rode around on a horse with a sword, and I wanted to be a hero like her. I'd tape every episode and go back and watch them and just pick apart the form of what she was doing, how she would do these flying sidekicks. And so I would kick down all the dead trees in the woods near my house.
Jessi braided her hair and cut her bangs to look like Xena. Sometimes she took the imitation even further.
I remember there was a bully who was like whacking his jacket at this girl who didn't have very many friends in school. And I was like this little 50-pound kid in sixth grade. I was a shrimp. And I just ran up and round-kicked him in the stomach. And he was so confused. He stopped and he just looked at me and he was like, "Did you just kick me?" Like, he didn't even know. And I was like, "Yeah." And I just walked to class.
Jessi ran the plan by her mom.
I told her, "When I grow up, I'm going to be the next Xena." And she was a Broadway dancer and actress, and she was like, "Well, maybe you could be your own hero." And I was like, no. When Lucy Lawless retires, they're going to need a new Xena, because obviously the world can't be without Xena. I'll just take her place. I'll be ready by then.
Young Jessi did all she could to prepare herself for a future as a warrior princess. She took circus classes, trained in flying trapeze, and competed in gymnastics. Then in high school, she picked up pole vaulting. She earned a scholarship to Nebraska, and she started pursuing a second dream, the Olympics. Jessie put the superhero plan on hold so she could focus on the sport. And soon, she was within an inch and a half of qualifying for Olympic trials. But during her junior year of college, Jessie stopped improving. She wasn't vaulting any higher.
I needed a new motivation, and I saw this ad on TV. It was like E! Entertainment or something. And they're like, yeah, they want to make a new Wonder Woman movie, and they haven't decided who to cast yet. They're thinking maybe somebody unknown. And I was like, I got to do it. I want to do it.
So the summer before her senior year, when Jessie was home in Maryland, she got a meeting with her mom's agent in Washington, D.C.
I took the train into the city and brought like a headshot and resume and all the stuff you're supposed to bring, and I handed it to her. And she looked over it and she goes, what is this? Do you even act? Why are you here? You know what? You should be a stunt woman here. And she just like shooed me out of the office as my head is spinning trying to understand what's happened, because I'd accidentally given her the resume that I made for the circus when I was in high school. I didn't realize it. And before I had a chance to explain, she's just telling me about stunts, and it all suddenly hit me. I was like, why didn't I think of this? Of course, a stunt woman. What could be more perfect?
Jessie started reading and researching all she could about life as a stunt double. She planned to move to LA after graduation, so she started studying maps of the city's neighborhoods. And even before finishing school, Jessie got her first opportunity. It was a big one. Most stunt doubles start out with relatively simple maneuvers, say, pretending to trip and fall. But when Jessie was on spring break, a non-union project needed a woman to do a backwards fall off a 50-foot building. Jessie hadn't joined the union yet, so she was one of the few people eligible for the job. That, and she was willing to do a backwards fall off a 50-foot building. Soon, Jessie was on a roof in the dark of night, pretending to be chased by a ghost.
The moment my feet left the building and I was in the air, all the stress was gone. And it was like, oh, this is where you belong. You're falling through the air. And that's what feels like home to me. I wanted to do it again, but they were like, no, that was perfect. We're done. Moving on. So it went quickly.
Jessie was hooked. In 2007, she graduated, moved to LA, and began looking for more work.
My first year in LA, I auditioned for all the live stunt shows, and I was really excited about the Pirates Dinner Adventure one, because there's singing and sword fights and trampolines and circus stuff, and it was like, it's everything I love. Only it turned out that the female character is actually a mute gypsy who gets kidnapped by pirates, so she doesn't get to do any fights. And it's just the damsel in distress the whole time. So I was a little disappointed.
Still, Jessie took the job. In her free time, she learned one of the male pirate roles, though she never got to perform it. Eventually, she found better stunt work. By her fourth year in LA, she was booked solid. Then in 2013, she made it onto a TV show that didn't involve any acting.
This summer, glory awaits on American Ninja Warrior.
On American Ninja Warrior, contestants take on obstacle courses. They jump from trampolines to dangling ropes and try other challenges that seem to have been dreamed up by a 12-year-old hopped up on pixie sticks with an unlimited construction budget. Men and women compete against each other on the same courses. Jessie heard about the show from one of her former roommates. She doubted she'd be very good at it, but she thought it'd be fun and maybe good publicity for her burgeoning stunt career. But it turns out the skills Jessie Graff had honed in her quest to become a warrior princess made her a great ninja warrior.
Jessie's parents and other family members here to watch tonight.
In 2015, the seventh season of the show, Jessie was one of the few women to make the national finals in Las Vegas. There, finalists try to finish four stages of obstacles. Out of the hundreds of competitors in the show's history, only two have ever completed all four. And most fail on the very first.
And it all starts with stage one. Eight obstacles built to test balance, agility, and speed.
When Jessie lined up for season seven, no woman in the history of the show had completed stage one. Jessie took her turn. She got off to a great start, passing the propeller bar, the silk slider, and the jumping spider.
And by reaching the warp wall, she's gone as far as any woman in history.
But she needs to get up the wall quickly. Oh!
The warped wall is one of the toughest obstacles. To get past it, you have to run up a nearly vertical ramp, grab hold of the top ledge, and pull yourself up. Think running up the side of an empty swimming pool, only the pool is 14 feet deep.
For women,
Jesse, come on, Jesse.
So close.
Man, it looks like she's gassed out. It looks like she doesn't have enough energy.
Just like when she tried to vault herself to the Olympics, Jesse Graff was a couple inches short. And for a seventh year, stage two of American Ninja Warrior began without a woman. The next year, Jesse Graff was one of 18 women in Las Vegas for the national finals. All the others failed on the first stage.
I was the last woman in the order. So before I went, like, all that information was in there, all of that pressure of, like, if you don't trip on something, you're going to make history and your life is going to change.
Once again, Jesse started out strong.
And she has a great pace going.
Come on, Jesse. Come on, Jesse.
Right back to technique onto the rope. Perfect. But now the warp wall. She couldn't get up it last year. In fact,
Jesse took her run at the wall.
As I was running up the wall, I realized that I had killed too much momentum and I wasn't going to make it. And so I just, like, I was reaching up with my right hand and I feel like I almost, like, shoved it out of its socket to get an extra inch.
Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Jesse Graff continues to deliver!
And as soon as my hand was over the top, I was like, oh my gosh, I did it. I'm going to finish stage one. And then instantly came back to reality and was like, dude, you have two more obstacles. Do not get ahead of yourself. Focus.
Jesse managed the broken bridge and the flying squirrel. And then...
she's going to make history! History! The first one right there to complete stage one. Jesse Graff has done it!
When I finally hit the buzzer at the top, and I just sank to the floor because I was like, you're done. You don't have to think anymore. I didn't even know what to do with myself. It was crazy.
Since her success on American Ninja Warrior, Jesse Graff has stayed busy as a stunt double. She's worked on the TV shows Supergirl and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and she's also been getting plenty of messages on social media. Women write to say that she's inspired them to get stronger or healthier. And parents send her videos of their young daughters doing pull-ups or climbing obstacles. In many of those videos, the girls are dressed in the same Wonder Woman skirt that Jesse has worn on American Ninja Warrior. Some have even done their hair in a high ponytail to look like Jesse.
I mean, I always wanted to play a hero, but I don't know that it ever really occurred to me that I could, like, just be a hero to people as myself. And that's really a dream come true. I mean, beyond the dreams that I had for myself. It's amazing.
That story was produced and reported by Onlia Games' Martin Kessler. The story originally aired last year, and since then, Jesse Graff has become the first woman to complete stage two of American Ninja Warrior. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Jesse Graff's mentor, Xena, Warrior Princess. Whoa! I guess she's a little busy right now. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.